Talk given Saturday, 5th July, 1975. It is important for us to see clearly what precisely differentiates the truly religious one from the worldly one. We know, in a general way, that the worldling is self-centered, that he tries to draw the world unto himself all the time, and that the main forces animating his whole life are the passion for pleasure, for success, for what he considers the expression of his faculties or whatever he believes he has to express. He is aware of his world in terms of an isolative self-consciousness. On the one hand, there am I. On the other hand, there is the world, the whole world. One is immediately struck by the peculiar disproportion of the importance which the worldling attaches to himself and to the world. He stands out vividly in his own consciousness. All the rest of the world is something secondary, something to exploit, not consciously necessarily, but unconsciously. And as long as we are conscious of our existence in terms of I and the world, of the self and the not-self, it is impossible to escape this exploitive, self-centered, egoistic, possessive attitude and the conflict which it engenders. Quite impossible to escape it. It is this which lies at the root of all the world's disorder and turmoil, its misery, its problems, and so on. Because each one of the 4,000 millions of the world is aware of the world in that same manner. And each person's desires, ambitions, self-misconceptions, and so forth, are different from everybody else's. So it is impossible to avoid the conflict. Throughout the ages, with very rare exceptions, all members of the human race have not been able to escape this fundamental mistake. I and the world, you and I, two separate creatures. Now, consider the other situation, the religious man, as we may call him. We may just as well call him the intelligent man, one who has clear perception of the fact, of the reality. He sees the world as a whole, as one total reality, of which he himself is integral part and parcel. If he really sees that, he also feels that. And if he feels that, in full measure, in as full measure as he sees that, there is a balance within himself and a remarkable degree of maturity of mind, which knows the truth, acknowledges the truth, and enables him, because of the combination of the cold intellectual perception with the warm feeling insight, because of that combination, he is able to live by it. And to live by it as second nature. Now, you may wonder, well, if it is a case of just clear-sighted perception and a good strong heart which feels this truth, why do we call it religious? What would you call religious but this? For the simple reason that he who can be aware of the one total reality as a one total reality is a person who is in relationship with, who is in harmony with transcendence itself. From the ordinary matter-of-fact point of view, each living being is indeed a separate living being. Each of the 4,000 millions in the world is a separate living being. And it is perfectly natural from the time he begins his life to grow to self-awareness. But to become free of the limitations imposed upon his mind and consciousness and his mode of daily living in the world, he has to become aware of the totality. Now, the totality is not only that which is conveyed to oneself through the senses or through the exercise of imagination or through the exercise of our logical intellectual processes. That is not sufficient. In becoming aware in this deep, intimate manner of totality, one becomes aware, not conscious in the ordinary analytical sense merely, but deeply aware of that which utterly transcends all limitation. It includes, in fact, what we commonly call the unknown. And not only does it include the unknown, but it also includes the unknowable. Because whilst constantly transcendence emerges into awareness in the person who cares for truth and reality, and thereby it becomes imminent and comes into the realm of the known, there is this vast realm which must necessarily forever remain unknown even to the perfected Holy One. For the simple reason that the man who becomes the perfected man, the true human, comes to a fruition which, marvelous and wonderful as it is just human fruition. It doesn't go beyond that. And there are absolutely no grounds for saying that there is nothing beyond. So, we must recognize all that. That there is not only what we commonly call the unknown, a part of which becomes known to us if we grow, if we understand, if we come to real fruition, but there is an immense part, an overwhelmingly immense part, which forever for mankind will always remain the unknown. Will remain the unknown and the unknowable. Someday, sometime, perhaps, the process of life, of which we know only such a fragment, may evolve a new kind of creature through us and through what we, the human race, do, who, this creature, will be one who will perhaps be able to be the instrument of what to us must ever remain unknowable. He will be the instrument for that part of that to become knowable. If one really sort of sees that quietly, calmly, then there is no room for conceit on our part. Nor, on the other hand, is there room for any false modesty or humility. We are free of the conflict of this false humility with conceit. But we are able to see something. We are able to have the vision, shall I say, of that towards which we are growing. Now the awareness of this is the awareness of something so marvelous, so wonderful, it is so transcendent to us as we are, that there is associated with this kind of vision an extraordinary reverence, a sense of awe, a sense of our infinity in terms of smallness, which has to be the instrument of infinity in terms of the vast totality. I put it in this form so that you'll appreciate that when we see that, seeing our smallness, there is humility. I know that I don't know. I know that I am nothing whatsoever. But this nothing, this one who doesn't know, is the very instrument for that transcendent reality which emerges out of the human and brings to fruition the purpose of the human kingdom itself. Hence I use the term religion and religiousness in this sense. Do not think of it in terms of a wonderful ideal. An ideal, I still stick to my old definition of the word ideal, which I put in my first book. An ideal is the culmination of an idea in the individual mind. But as a culmination, it becomes a fixed mental construct. It becomes a mental fixation. That is the ideal towards which we are working, as we say. People by the thousand do that, working towards an ideal. But an ideal is a bond. It is a compulsive force. It limits one. And the ideal, if we stick to what we call a clear perception of an ideal, it prevents us from true growth and from arriving at what is in actual fact and reality fruition for us individually. Because every person's fruition is a unique fruition. Because we are all unique. The ideal prevents that. Why? Because this fixed mental construct prevents living growth. Growth is a living thing. It is not a cumulative thing. It is not something where there is just mere acquisition. It is something which is mysterious, which is wonderful, which is unique from moment to moment. And all the forces at play which bring about this growth are something which lie completely beyond our ken. When you and I were born, did we have the slightest concept or idea of how we would grow? Just physically, say, what we would look like in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, 50 years' time, 100 years' time? Had we the slightest idea of what potentialities there lay within us, or what duds we were, and just how we would get on mentally, emotionally, and so on? Not the slightest idea. We don't know. And when we predetermine things, we set false limits upon ourselves. Constrictions which cause conflict within ourselves and conflict with the outer world, with everybody around us. But this fixation, which is the ideal, is quite different from the sensible, practical thing, namely seeing the general trends of life. Which way is life trending for me? Each one must see for himself. Am I going to be the world's finest chess player, or am I going to be a gentle, nice housewife, or am I going to be a virago, or whatever it is, you see? Just see the trend of life. And wheresoever one sees a trend, or more than one trend in one's own life, which is in harmony with the great spiritual values as such, love and truth and wisdom and beauty and goodness and purity, then certainly bend your energies towards letting that trend take you along and bring you to fruition. Because it will bring you to a fruition which is far more wonderful and beautiful than anything which you achieve by preconceiving it with the imperfect mind, which is only the slave of desire and dominated by foolish, wayward desire. See how different life is for the religious, for the religious mind, for the religious man. So that you will see that even those ideals which have been laid down in the name of religion are fixations. Utilize what you see is really good in them and indicating the next step forward for you. Utilize them. But don't let yourself be imprisoned for the rest of your days in this is the ideal, I mustn't step out of this. You have to grow out of it. And you can't determine how you will grow. Life does that for you. This is where humility comes in. Not my will, but thine, O Lord. See? It's that way. And this is so difficult. All our upbringing, all our education is a failure, actually. We see these things through terrible suffering. We die 100 deaths, 1,000 deaths in the course of our life. But if we are willing to die, psychologically, of course, if you die physically, that's the finish. But if we are willing to die these 1,000 deaths and keep the heart gentle, soft, absorbing everything that comes unto us, and the mind free and open, saying, yes, it seems so, it seems so, this is how it appears to be, let us be watchful, let us observe carefully, and grow in insight and understanding, then this marvelous fruition will come into being for you. That is to say, through you. If you think of putting this into practice because, oh, it will be for my fruition, then there will be only failure. It is only the one total reality, the universe, which comes to fruition, not you or I or any object or any particular. But insofar as the total reality comes to fruition through oneself, the individual, oneself also has come to fruition. One has not obstructed the Tao. This is so important. We are the children of this transcendent marvel, this unspeakable, unknown, unknowable, this unborn, unbecome, unmade, this eternal reality. We are the children of it all. It is this eternal reality which expresses, that is, presses out of itself each one of us as a manifestation, infusing the potentiality of perfect man within each and every one of us. It is for us not to resist this total reality, but to be open to it, heart and mind. To be totally unresisting and see which way we are being made to grow. This is very important. Now you see the contrast between the worldling and the religious, the religious man and religious minded person. How will What are the signs which will indicate that one is living religiously? That one is coming to human fruition? It's very simple to put it in words. Perfect purity of conduct, conduct of body, of speech, and of mind, which will imply in fruition, in real religious living, freedom from this compulsive, uncontrollable reaction to anything and everything in terms of fear, of violence, of misperception and misconception, of delusions and illusions, and so forth. So one begins to see the importance of this constant mindfulness, this being awake, watchful. Sama sati, said the Buddha. We take hold of the words. Do we really begin to penetrate the tremendous import of each of those elements in the Eightfold Way? Sama sati, perfect mindfulness. Jesus said, watch and pray. Just as the Buddha said, samasati and samasamadhi. The two are the identical teachings, each in his own terms. Watch and pray. What is pray? Samadhi. This is the supreme prayer, the supreme communion. Are we at all aware of the tremendous import of this mindfulness? We are quite earnest. We are sincere in our effort. Let us grant that to start with. But in what manner do we practice mindfulness? At the back of our minds, some such process like this goes on. The enlightened one taught the importance of mindfulness. By being mindful, I shall become free of dukkha, which I translate as suffering, as ill, as pain, as sorrow. Pain, ill, sorrow, this little brain understands only in terms of my pain, my ill, my sorrow, which is understood as the frustration of my desires, the loss of my little security or bank balance or whatever it is, being jilted by my girlfriend or my boyfriend and all that kind of thing. You see? And then what does the mind do? The mind tries to compensate for all that by saying, but these things are all ephemeral, I mustn't cling to them. I shall be very mindful and I shall attain a state of happiness. There's your little worm inside the apple. I shall realize the state of happiness. Actually, what happens is more or less something like this, that I make myself like an iceberg, make myself indifferent inwardly to what is felt deep in the subconscious as loss, as a diminution of my ego, as hurt to my personal vanity, my amour propre, and so forth. And I'm not mindful, I'm not awake to all these deep workings inside the mind. You see? I and the world. I am being mindful of the world and of what happens to me. There are two, these everlasting two. And wheresoever there are these everlasting two, this duality, which has not realized true, complete, and perfect relationship, there is illness. The real meaning of dukkha. Dukkha, its first and fundamental meaning, far from the infinite. The infinite distorted, spoilt, made bad. And curiously enough, in Buddha Ghosha's Visuddhimagga, you'll find it. He also puts in made contemptible. Now, far from the infinite. That means far from the immeasurable. And when something is far from the immeasurable, the immeasurable spoilt or distorted, it has been forcibly brought into the sphere of the measurable. You see, it has become limited. It has become cut off from the one total reality. Just as this dominant I consciousness is a cutting off of this living organism, which the one total reality produced into the world from the one total reality. So you see how deep this goes. It is brought into the sphere of the measurable, and the moment it is brought into the sphere of the measurable, I am the measurer. And because this separate I is the imperfect, the distorted, the subhuman, and too often the inhuman creature. What can happen here for the human being to come into fruition? You see how each one of us is the generator, the nurturer and perpetuator of dukkha, of the ill state. Do try and feel into the depths of it with your whole awareness. Don't just indulge in any brilliant intellectual analysis. The light of intellect by itself is futile and usually misleading. When the skill of intellect is wholly in service of the light of the heart, which is pure love, unpossessive, undemanding, then the intellect works rightly, otherwise it fails. The intellect is the thing that preserves the separateness. Why has it been presented in the Judeo-Christian tradition that Lucifer, the bright morning star, the brightest of the angels in heaven, was the one who rebelled and fell into hell? The brightest. This light of intellect, beware of it. See, it was he who tried to bring separation between the totality represented by the Almighty and him, a creation of the Almighty. To the light of intellect. Now too you will see why spiritual pride is one of the last things to go. It's so tricky. So, don't try to get the intellect alone to work, to understand these things. But become aware. And awareness is a feeling, first. The seeing, which involves shape, symmetry, proportion, and limited size, comes later. This awareness is a thing of the heart. The heart, not merely in the sense, not in the sense of emotion or of something vague, but in the heart in the sense of the one total mind, the universal mind, the all mind. That is the heart. Hridaya, which the Sanskrit word we use, and which one of its meanings is the heart in the ordinary physical sense, heart. But in the religious context particularly, and in the psychological sense, it refers to the essence of mind. It refers, in fact, to pure mind, absolute mind. Well, what can pure absolute mind mean? Is it measurable? Is it particularized? Is it finite? Or is it the totality? It is akin to the word akasha. It is akin to the Greek word chaos in its original sense, that primordial condition which was the utterly undisturbed condition, holding within itself all the potentiality for the emergence and coming to fruition of a great cosmos out of chaos. It is only later that the word chaos began to mean disorder. So you see, this thing which we call awareness, which is beyond, which includes discriminative analytical consciousness, vijnana. This is the vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato bhavam, which in the Upanishads is simply called by one word, atma. It's the identical thing. The Orthodox Buddhist world will quarrel with me about it and say, oh, that's entirely false doctrine, heretical doctrine. I'm delighted that they see it as heretical doctrine. Because there are heresies which are the most tremendous force for regeneration and creative renewal, just as there are heresies for bringing about man's ill conduct also. But this will bring you creative renewal. It is this total reality, Atma. And you know, it was called, they called it Atma in the Upanishads because it was realized in profound meditation through the process of the denudation of what we commonly call my mind. When my mind is completely denuded of all its concepts, its constructs, its ideas, beliefs, convictions, modes of thought, its touch with archetypal energies as such, all that gets denuded, then what there is the one universal mind, pure light, which is invisible. All that is visible by virtue of reflection, not by virtue of intrinsic self-being, svayambhu, self-being, independent. Not dependent on anything. Therefore, the ultimate reality. Here, this you will find in the deeps of all the great teachings, whether they are derived from the Kabbalistic tradition or the Vedic tradition. So you see, this awareness, this heart, the Hridaya, this is the all mind, the pure mind, untrammeled, not limited, because not appropriated by, and which cannot be appropriated by me as my mind. So you see, the difference between the worldling and the religious man. The religious man is utterly free of mind. In the meaning of the word mind as used by the worldling is proud of his mind. Oh, I've got a good mind for this, that and the other. That means he's got limited mental processes, which are all fundamentally the activity of his speech faculty synthesizing sense impressions and producing all kinds of shapes, ephemeral passing shapes, which he mistakes for eternal reality. This is the trouble. The religia is mindless in that sense. You know, scholars have always been completely stumped by some of the statements in the Upanishads. When through pure mindfulness he comes to the state of mindlessness, then that is the supreme state, as the texts say. And the scholar holds his hands up in horror and says, what? The man arrives at a state of vacuity? He might become a complete idiot with nothing, a mindless creature. And they say, this is the supreme state. What sort of teaching is this? It is a teaching which is a little bit beyond the capacity of the scholar to begin to understand. Now, if the scholar wants to understand this, he must go through the process of the purification of his mind and his morals. And let there be no mistake about it. The importance of the pure life can never be overestimated or overemphasized. Look into the scriptures. What did the great teachers teach? Be harmless. Be truthful. Be unpossessive, ungrasping. In Buddhism, they said, keep away from drinks, as the fifth precept, and drugs, and so forth. Honor thy father and mother. Make no images of me, amongst the commandments. Do not murder. That is, of course, putting in a very dramatic form what is stated as be harmless. Harmless to yourself, harmless to the entire universe. These are about the fundamental teachings and the most important teachings of the great religious teachers. Why did all of them teach in that way? Because once that is done, once one is growing in that way, then this transformation of one's mode of awareness of existence from the self-centered mode, I and the world, into the clear awareness by being that which you are aware of the one total reality, comes to full fruition. That is why they taught these things. So you see, if we mean business with living the religious life, we have to see this. We don't know the meaning of living the religious life. It is important for the brain at first to clear its cobwebs and begin to see the implications and the significance of the religious life. Then the discipline emerges naturally from within. But if I turn to religion because I've been frustrated in the world, I've been disappointed, then I turn to religion for comfort, for winning that which I lost in the ordinary way in everything in the world. But this is nothing other than the same sort of self-seeking. And that has nothing to do with the religious life. And it is done in the name of religion. In the name of living the good life. So I wear all the cloaks of virtue, you see, and imagine myself such a charming, nice saint now, where formerly I was such a horrible devil, and so forth, you see. I compensate myself, remaining blind to the fact I'm just as egoistic, vain, ignorant as ever. Beware of these things. They are so deep-seated, you know, this is the trouble. I don't say these things cynically, sarcastically, critically, or in the spirit of superiority or any such thing. But because when one has really even seen it to some extent, there comes out of the heart pure compassion. This is the sorrow of the world. This is the dukkha of the world. It's the sorrow of every individual human being too, you see. And so, one's whole being is filled with this mysterious thing, compassion, which is not a thing of pleasure, it is not a thing of pain. It is something transcendent. It is not love in the ambivalent sense of love, the opposite of hate. It is not the opposite of hate. This thing, compassion. This word, compassion, represents the living stuff of your unknown and unknowable being in its totality. That is what the word compassion represents. So too the word wisdom in the religious context. So too the word purity, beauty, goodness, truth. All these words represent just that living stuff of your unknown and unknowable being in its ultimate reality. And it is all this which is the unknown power, the mysterious power and energy, which works through your psychophysical organism, bringing to fruition, trying to bring to fruition something which is altogether too marvelous and beautiful. You and I cannot conceive of it. We shouldn't try to conceive of it, because our conceptions will be like smearing a truly beautiful face with some horrible marks. You don't try to gild the lily, do you? That's how it is.